I'm really excited to see this big a crowd for WPF here. So thank you very much for coming here to learn about what's new with WPF. How many of you are already WPF devs? Ooh, represent. That's awesome. How many of you are here because you've never used WPF, but you heard about how awesome a thing it was and want to learn about it? Also good. And how many people have never seen a line of XAML in their life? I know you're out there. You're just not saying it. Okay. I have the post-lunch session, so I'll try and keep it lively, maybe make you exercise or something like that to try and kind of like work it off, work off the meal. My name is Pete Brown, and I work for Microsoft. I am the XAML platform evangelist, primarily focusing on Windows, but of course also on WPF and Silverlight as well, a little bit on Windows Phone. Basically, if it has angle brackets that are not HTML, I'm interested in that. So let's talk a little bit about WPF today. I'm going to show you a lot of slides and a lot of demos. There's just a lot. The slides are going to go by fairly quickly, but I've put them together specifically because you're going to want to download them later on, get some of the specifics off of those slides. A couple of eye charts in there. I'm not expecting you to absorb that all in this. There's no quiz at the end of this session. So I just came from a session over at the Hilton. By the way, never book back-to-back things at opposite ends of TechEd. TechEd is not a small conference. But I just came from a session at the Hilton where we were talking about what do you need to learn to kind of future-proof your skills? Like, what are the things that you're going to have to learn moving forward? Was anybody in here actually at that? Oh, cool. Thank you. I should have just had you carry my stuff over, and I wouldn't have to do it myself. And we didn't actually talk about sort of like specific micro-level skills and stuff like that. But one of the things I was thinking as these folks were asking these questions is one of the skills that you can learn and, you know, have something that's going to move forward in the future, regardless of what we call it, is XAML and either C# or Visual Basic. So if you are a XAML and .NET developer, you can use WPF, which is what we're talking about here. You can also do work in Metro XAML. How many of you have written Metro applications using XAML? Excellent. Okay, a few of you folks. You can do work in XAML and C++, of all things. We believe we've actually extended XAML support for Metro applications so that you can build native C++ applications with XAML. So, in fact, we are expanding the reach of this UI platform. And it has dependency properties and all the types of things that you would expect to see in a XAML platform. And, of course, Windows Phone and Silverlight on the desktop and browser. Any Silverlight devs? You guys should have raised your hand in the keynote the other day. I knew you were out there. All right. So let's look at WPF4 a little bit. So WPF4 is a release that is out there right now. It is the stable release, the release that I hope all of you in here are using at this point. Any of you still stuck on 3.5? Excellent. Well, not excellent for him, but excellent for the rest of you. So WPF4 is, to me, one of the very best releases that we have done for WPF in terms of the breadth of new features and the breadth of performance enhancements and everything that we've added into that. It's an extremely strong release. This is the place where we got font rendering right. Right? This is the place where we added in Data Grid and Date Picker and Calendar and all those types of things that you folks have been asking for quite a long time. We also pulled in some of the features from Silverlight. Silverlight was on a faster revision cycle, so we're able to pioneer some of the stuff with Silverlight, things like Visual State Manager and stuff, and then pull that into WPF as we saw how it did. So we pulled over things like Visual State Manager for making it easier, I think. I'm a big fan of VSM. Making it easier to set up how your UI is going to react to different types of input events and different state and whatnot, as well as things like easing functions were so much nicer than actually trying to go through and figure out the Bezier curves manually. If you ever did that in Blend, you're like, well, if I sort of tilt things this way, it's sort of a bounce, and if I don't. So easing functions made it a whole lot easier for us to be able to provide interesting animations. Although, I know at least one or two people in here probably did the bounce that bounces like 30 times before it stabilizes on the screen, right? So that's really great for input forms. Just have them slide out and sort of dangle there for 10 minutes before the user can actually enter anything. All right, enough about WPF4. Right now, we're in the middle of WPF 4.5 as part of the .NET 4.5 release. We have just released the release candidate of this. That was back in May. The features that you see in that are stable. Unless something drastic happens, those are the features that we're looking to go into the final release with, right? So the features that are there today, I think you're going to find out there in the final release. We still have some bugs to fix and some synchronization between Windows 8 and some other stuff that we need to work in there. But again, feature-wise, it's pretty stable. There is a go-live license. Any of you doing WPF 4.5 and doing a go-live on that now? Not a one. Okay, a cautious group. I understand. There is a go-live license, though. And the RC is pretty stable. I know you've heard lots of Microsoft people come up and say, the RC is really stable. It actually is very stable. We run it internally for our own applications. We also, of course, run Windows 8 RC or release preview for our own applications and stuff as well. So I feel pretty confident in telling you that. WPF 4.5 has a different set of platforms supported for it than the previous version of WPF. So if you want to develop for WPF 4.5 and .NET 4.5 in general, you can do that on Windows 7 or Windows 8, right? You're not going to do that on XP or Vista or something like that. So it's Windows 7 or Windows 8. You can also use our Windows Server products. Any of you running Server on your desktop still? A few folks, okay. Not the person stuck in 3.5 in the corner, I noticed, but that's okay. Runtime support, pretty much the same thing. We're looking at this as kind of our forward-looking platform for .NET. So some of the drivers that we had for creating WPF 4.5, you see there's like, you can imagine, I blurred out the text on these little sticky notes on the side here, but you don't actually have to have them blurred out because I don't think anybody can read that. But that is the window of one of the PMs that we had on the WPF team who was taking the different features that you have requested, the features that internal teams have requested, the features that our external large partners have requested, had them all up on their window, and they were arranging them, prioritizing different stuff like that. So you can see our our analysis board here was not super high-tech, but I think it did the job. How many of you voted for features on user voice? One person. What feature did you vote for? Better performance. All right, so we do have better performance, so that's good. I didn't plant him in the audience, I swear to God. We had a kind of a program that we were trying out with WPF that we've also used on ASP.NET and some other products and Silverlight and whatnot, where we had a user voice set up, and folks would submit requests and say, hey, this is what I want to see in the next version of WPF. And then other folks would come in and vote it up, right? I don't think you could vote down, but basically you get like 10 points and you can spread it across however which many ones that you wanted to use. And we use that as input into our early parts of our development process. Now, we're not doing that for WPF 4.5 anymore, of course, because of where we are. But very early in the process, we took those top features and we laid them out on a grid at the bottom and said, hey, What are the kind of like the cost of the different features versus the number of people who really wanted them, and that's helped also with a little bit of the prioritization. Okay, so the key thing I want you to understand is that we took input from you all, or him specifically, right? We took input from you guys, we took input from our large customers that we had out there, and we took input from our internal teams. We happen to have a fairly well-invested customer internally who would like to see WPF do well, and that is, of course, Visual Studio and the related products there, too. We took all of those inputs together, and that's how we came up with what we were putting in, into WPF 4.5. So here's a bit of an eye chart. Some of the things that you see here, like the new async and await and the task T support, those are built into the .NET platform as a whole. But we are taking advantage of them in WPF. We now have a built-in ribbon control. It's in System Windows Controls ribbon, but it's delivered with the product. It's no longer a separate download. We have a lot of other small targeted updates that you all and the customers have specifically asked for, saying, hey, we want to be able to do cross-thread collection access. Hey, we want to be able to do data binding delay because that solves a particular problem. We want to stop memory leaks, so we want weak references for our events. We don't want to have to go through and rely just on kind of manual removal of those events. And for folks taking pictures of the slides, this will all be up later on, so I'll make sure the slide deck's available to you pretty much right away. We also added in iNotify data error info from Silverlight, custom type providers, accessing collections I mentioned, live shaping, which was important for people dealing with kind of changing data sets of very large amounts of data. The ribbon control itself, how many of you used the ribbon before we rolled it in? A couple of folks. How many of you used it way back when you had to do all the paperwork and stuff for it? How many of you just said, I'm going to use it anyway, and I'm not going to mess with the paperwork? Yeah, all right. That's nobody's willing to admit that. The camera's not actually pointing that way, so don't worry. It's not going to get you. So we've rolled that in. We've made it simpler to use the ribbon. We have the ribbon window. We have the ribbon control itself, ribbon tabs, ribbon groups, ribbon buttons, ribbon. That sounds a bit like a frog up here. We have all of those built in there and very easy to... There we go. Very easy to use from WPF. So let's go over here. I'm running a Windows 8 machine, as you can see here. Ooh, okay. Pull this over. And I am running the RC here, same stuff that you guys have, or should have. Any of you running the RC? Excellent. Oops. Pull this up. Wrong one. Here we go. All right, so I want to go in and create a new ribbon control. So I'm going to go into my main Windows YAML. And I can go ahead and add the ribbon, and I'm going to add a reference to it first. So let me right-click here. Right-click. There we go. Add reference. Ribbon. There we go. So system windows controls ribbon. Okay. And then I can go in and just say ribbon. I'm fine. I can say ribbon group or ribbon tab. I'm not big on design surfaces. We do have a good design surface. The ribbon itself doesn't have designer support, but you can see it on the designer. I tend to type a lot of XAML, so that's what I'm going to be doing in here. As a ribbon tab, header equals hello, and just leave it at that for the moment. If I go over and you see we get the normal ribbon stuff, right? We also have the ribbon window, which you're probably familiar with. There is a bug. I'll say it's a bug because it's a bug, right? But it's really kind of a mismatch right now where if you do run this on Windows 8, the border of the window is going to look something like a VB4 application. That's temporary. We didn't actually add that in. That wasn't one of the features requested on User Voice, make my apps look more like VB. So let me go and say ribbon window here so you can see what that looks like. Resolve that. And then go into my XAML. Let's get back. There we go. Get out. And just because I want you to see what this looks like, because you might see it on other applications. And if you're doing something with some of these intermediate builds, you might even get a bug reported on some of your own apps that use it. So see what the border of the window looks like? Right. So that's just a little bit of a mismatch here between what we're doing with Windows and what we're doing with WPF, and that's something that will be fixed by the time this all fully releases. Okay. All right, but it does work. Now, if you don't want that, I don't know how many people want that. How many people want that look? Because I can put it in as a feature request to keep that permanent if you would like. No? All right. So let me go in and change these. And we don't have a template for the ribbon window itself, so you do have to go in and manually set those up, but that's not a terrible thing right now. If you just run it normally, here you get the regular look, right? But you do get that bar across the top, and you can disable that and stuff. So it's really, because the ribbon window custom paints its Chrome, right? We just need to get that in sync with what's going on the window side. And it custom paints its Chrome because normally you can have all the quick access tools and stuff up there on the toolbar itself, or up there on the Chrome itself. So let me go in and, through the magic of fast typing, check that out. Did you guys even see that? You didn't see that? I'm going to do it one more time just because I think it's the coolest thing. Let me do it one more time here. And then I don't think I'll tell you how I did it. X1. If you go home right now and type X1 into your own code, it won't do a thing. So here we go. So now I've got a ribbon that's got a bunch of other stuff here. I've got the doctor's group. I've got a demo group, a bunch of other things as well. Okay. That tool I'm using is actually this one right here, called AutoHotkey. Right. So if you ever do demos yourself, this tool called AutoHotkey is very cool. It uses the accessibility API to just look for keystrokes, and it works in any application. So if you had this running, and I had to actually type like X1 equals or something in my code, then it's going to come up with a big chunk of XAML in there, which would be really kind of bad. Okay. All right. So let's take a look at the next thing here, and I'm going to use this ribbon as we're going through the rest of the application, so that you can see how it actually works. Async and await support is one of the other really big features that has made it into .NET 4.5. You can also, if you're using Visual Studio 2012, you can also use this in Silverlight if you're interested. There's a download that you can get that'll give you access to async and await. The support isn't quite as good because the Silverlight APIs haven't been adjusted to return tasks. But what this does is it makes it really, really easy for you to create asynchronous code without having to do all the callbacks and event handlers and all the other junk that normally goes along with asynchronous code. So when I first started in Silverlight before, we learned that asynchronous was the only choice that you had. If you wanted to make a networking call, you had to do as an async call. A lot of WPF developers were following similar approaches because it gives you better performance. Like, the first several Twitter clients that were created in WPF didn't do the calls asynchronously, so they had some issues with, the UI would lock up while they were waiting for the network call to come back and all that kind of stuff, and that just wasn't really a great experience, so they did the calls asynchronously. The problem with async code is it's usually, make the request, then you set up some sort of callback or something, and you get back a response, right? So you have two different functions, whether they're anonymous delegates or Lambda expressions or whatever, you still have two different functions in there. And then if you need to, say, make another networking call based upon the results of the first one, then you've got another nested one inside there, right? And that's actually pretty typical in business applications. I'm going to make the assumption that most of you in here are business application developers. Is that correct? Yes? No? Oh, yes. Okay. I saw some head nods. Not counting the folks that were nodding off, but yes, I saw some head nods. So you had to make these asynchronous calls, and they really were a pain in the butt. And that's why nobody did them until they were forced to. In Windows 8, when you're building Metro-style applications, pretty much everything is asynchronous. I won't say every last thing, but a lot of things are asynchronous, not just networking calls, but file access and reading from streams and a bunch of other things there are all asynchronous. So .NET 4.5, knowing that and also trying to make sure that we keep everything here kind of in sync, has included support for the task parallel library, which I know a lot of folks really like, as well as the support for the async and await keyword, which work in C#, and there's also an equivalent version of that works in Visual Basic, if I remember correctly, to be able to make these asynchronous calls a single line, right? So you just do mark the function as async, then you say await some call that's going to come back, and then the compiler, and this is the cool part, behind the scenes, the compiler is not generating code, but it is rewriting your function and creating it into a state machine that goes through and stores its state for all the variables that you have inside that function in a specialized structure or a specialized class that are going to be stored over on the heap, right? And then it goes through and yields control at certain points and waits for the calls to come back. And when the calls come back, it goes and executes the functions inside the code right at that point as well. So I put up a blog post on this? I think I put up a blog post on this that showed some of the IL that actually gets generated from that. And it's really kind of cool to see what the compiler is doing on your behalf. Now keep in mind, this isn't some generated mystery code that's going in a .g.cs file or something that you have to worry about. This is the compiler rewriting it, so you can be pretty confident that we've done the right thing here and all that stuff's going to work as expected. But it really does simplify your code. So rather than me continuing to yap on that, let's take a look at it. I'm going to give the projector guys a workout with switching the screen here all the time. So let's take this load function here. And I'm just going to stick in an event handler. Say click, pop that in there. Now if I want to make a network call, I can say web client Let's see, var client equals new web client. Resolve that. And I'm just going to download a page here. I'm going to pick a completely random site that I happen to own. Client dot, and it's download string task. Sorry, download string task async. So that's a ridiculously named function. We have download string async, which is going to give us the callback approach, and then we have download string task async. And what that does is it returns, as we saw in the IntelliSense there, it returns a task. Now, I'm going to give it an address. This is a totally awesome website. You should check it out. It's my site, sorry. So I'm going to give it a task. Now, normally what I would get back from this when I make this function call here is I would just get back that task. But if you notice really quick there, you see it says it's awaitable, right, inside that little pop-up that comes up. Does that show up there? Yes, it does. Okay, good. So that's marked as awaitable. So that means rather than having to wire up those handlers, I can just say var results equals await. And then I go up here and I say this function is async because it's not going to let me do it unless I mark the function async. And then right after this, I'm going to say debug.writeline results. Okay, and let me put a breakpoint in so you can see it. All right, so when I click on load, and if I just step through here, so I create the web client, then I await that call, and then I get the results back, right? And it printed out down here at the bottom. No handlers necessary. So I think that's actually one of my very favorite features in .NET 4.5, because I like to do asynchronous operations, not because I like to write asynchronous code, but because I think asynchronous operations are often the right way to write this kind of code. And I've always hated the process of writing it before, and this just makes it a whole lot easier. Okay? Have you all seen that before? No? Okay. Hope they didn't serve anything heavy for lunch today. All right. Let's get back to that. All right, so, and in case you're wondering, await is a modifier, async is a modifier, and await is an operator, so in case that ever comes up in Trivial Pursuit or something like that. Next feature that we have here is binding delay. So if you think about binding a scroll bar or binding a, anything that's going to change a lot based upon what the user is doing, so even like mouse positions and all sorts of things like that, every time that value changes, you're getting change notification events back into the rest of the system. And this is one of the things that can make binding slow. I am a huge, huge fan of data binding in all the XAML-based products here. But I do understand that when you're dealing with lots and lots of updates and lots of data, that you really can end up with performance issues. So one of the things that we've done here is we've created the ability to set a binding delay. And what that does is it checks to see if the value has changed in the last whatever configurable number of milliseconds that you provided. If the value has not changed in that amount of time, then it's going to actually just go through and do all the updates then. But it's not going to do all the interim updates. So if I'm moving a scroll bar across, and it's not going to do anything until I stop moving for however many milliseconds. And this is really, really easy to do. In this case, I'm using element binding directly in XAML. And you just need to make sure that you set up the delay on the source. So in this case, the source is a slider. And again, easier just to show you. So I think I'll pop on back over to here. And I'll go back again to my magic keystrokes. X2, enter, boom, there you go. So I'm going to do this without any delay. You'll see what happens. So here we have the number 50. And when I move it across, you see it's going to change for every little pixel and every bit that I move, technically at the fraction of a pixel even. All right, so now I can say, after the element name stuff here, I can say delay equals 500. And you own this number, so it's whatever you want. It's in milliseconds. All right, So now it's not going to change until I stop. So here we go. I'm moving, stop. Here we go. Moving, stop. Right? So you can control, again, when the updates happen. And if you think about, again, all the update, not just the binding system update notifications, but if you're doing anything that's related to iNotify property change or any other property change events, it cuts way, way back on the amount of traffic going through the system. And that's a good thing. This goes directly to performance, which one of you guys brought up over there. Okay. The next thing is binding expression APIs. Again, you all have come to us and said, we want more visibility into what's happening in the binding system. So we've come up with some ways to do that. And one of the things here is being able to inspect, as part of the binding expression, being able to see what the resolve source was, what the final target, what the final target property was, et cetera. That's all something that you can inspect at runtime if you need to perform some sort of operation based upon that. So if it's bound to something of type X, do one thing. If it's bound to something of type Y, do another thing. That's not something I have personally run into on projects, but I know that we got this request over and over again, especially in data-driven systems and systems where the types of data can change quite a bit. We also have the ability now to bind to static properties. So, and I want to caution you a little bit on this. Binding to static properties can be a potential source of a bug in your system, potentially a memory leak because static classes stay around forever. Or essentially forever as far as we're concerned. So I just want to make sure you understand when you're binding to that, we're kind of keeping that alive. But you have the ability now to bind to a static class or property on that class using a special syntax that has the namespace as well as parentheses there. So, of course, I would consider other approaches to this, but sometimes this is going to be the only way to solve the specific problem. Again, the syntax for that, we do parentheses, the namespace is going to be your normal XAML, XAML namespace, like local or whatever, and then class.property. And then the class itself needs to, doesn't need to implement an interface, but it does need to raise this static property changed event, and that static property changed event is going to be what provides the change notification back to the rest of the system. So again. Warning, all these screen flickers may cause seizures, right? All right. There's X3 here. So I haven't set up the namespace for this yet, but the other thing I wanted you to see here, we have an improvement over the previous version of Visual Studio 2012, where we had the blue squiggly underneath the entire statement when you... so now it's just under the first part of it. We're getting there. Eventually it'll be no squiggly. But I want you to know that Visual Studio right now doesn't completely understand that that's a valid statement, right? So now if I set up the namespace, local, and then pull that up. Let's see, that's, here we are. And that'll resolve it. And so what I have in here is this application settings class. And this application settings class has this static event called static property changed, and it has a single property title in this case, which I'm setting right there in a constructor. So you're not going to see the property change happen, but the fact that you can bind to it itself is kind of interesting. I call that notify static property change function, which is one of just my typical wrappers around the function name itself. You guys have probably written this 1.5 million times, but this is something, again, that's a little bit new here. So let's run this. And you should see Hello Tech Ed come up. There we go. And that's right in that bit of XAML that I bound to. So let's take a look at the XAML again. Parentheses, namespace, class name, property name. All right, so a little bit different syntax than we have for binding to instance properties. All right. There we go. Weak events. How many of you have ever had a memory leak because you had an event handler that you didn't realize was holding onto an instance of like a giant form? Yeah, I figured. And all the rest of you who didn't raise your hands, you actually have one and you don't know it. So one of the best practices is to always kind of remove your event handlers after you've finished with them. But that's not something that most people do in their applications because everything seems to work fine without doing that, right? So one of the patterns that has come out is called the weak event pattern. And the weak event pattern makes it possible for you to have a broker. So you have, here's your You know, here's the source of the event, and here's the thing that's going to sync the event. Here's a, you know, like a form or whatever like that. And you have a broker in the middle that's going to hang around and see what, you know, what's the lifetime of these different objects. And it's the broker that you're going to have references to, right? So, you know, you can solve any problem in computer science by a level of indirection. This is one of those examples. Now, we had this previously in WPF. So how many of you have used the weak event pattern in WPF? Cool. Those are the people that don't have memory leaks right now. So we've had this before, but we didn't have it really baked in real well into the framework. We now have a generic weak event manager that is really simple to use. It does use reflection, so there's a slight performance hit because it's using reflection to look up the names of the event name and stuff. So again, use that understanding that there is a reflection lookup in there. And if you want something that really performs well, you can derive your own from that. That's a very specific weak event manager that is specific to your classes and your uses. So if I go back into my code behind, and let me apologize for putting all my code in the code behind here, but I'll just leave it at that. So if I, let's see, if I remove my main window here and use X4, right? What I've done here is I have a ViewModel class that's in this project, which I'll show you in a second. And that ViewModel class has in it a collection, an observable collection. You guys know that observable collections raise collection change notifications pretty much constantly. So every time you're adding and removing things, you're getting change notifications. So it's pretty typical for us to go and want to wire up to that event. So I have this observable collection, and I want to be able to add and remove stuff to it, but I want to be able to get the change notification information from that, but I don't want to have a strongly typed event as part of that. So what I've done is I've called weak event manager of type observable collection of stock. That's what I have hanging off the view model. And I pass that in the type of the callback, the type of the event args, if you will, the notify collection change event args. And then I call this add handler function, providing it the instance of the class that I'm talking about. And then scrolling all the way over to the right here, the event name and then my handler. So that string, that collection change string right there, that's where we're going to do the lookup the actual name of the event behind the scenes. So that's where you can get a little bit of a performance issue if you keep doing this over and over again, right? And so if I want to use this, let me get rid of this other load code I had here. And I'm going to call, let's see, my main view model here has an add new items function that's going to go through and just keep adding a bunch of items. I think it goes to 100 items. So if I go back and say in load click, I'm going to say vm.add new items. I'm going to get rid of this async keyword. You can leave the async keyword there. You're going to get a compiler warning that says you mark this as async, but there are no await statements in here, so I'm not going to do anything, right? So please remove it. I always think it's funny when the compiler knows exactly what you need to do but doesn't just do it. So it's going to complain there about that. That's okay. I removed it. All right, so now I'm going to add items. So I'm going to call load, right? And you see down here in the immediate window, or in the output window, excuse me, let's see, Windows plus, right? And the warning, I'll explain what that is in a second. But you see, I got the collection changed event, and it spit out the count and whatnot, and that was done through that weak event manager code. So use a weak event manager to actually set up the relationship between the view model and the form to hook that event up, right? And then I have some normal callback, looks like any other event handler, in my code behind or in whatever code that you want to have that does code just like you would anything else, okay? And then just having that level of indirection in there gives you better control over the lifetime of that relationship. There are functions on the weak event manager to help you manage that lifetime manually if you want. And I can just keep loading this if I'd like, 200, 300, 400. Now, the little errors that were coming up, because I don't want to have errors come up on the screen and then pretend I didn't see them, but there were little errors that you saw that were binding errors on the bottom. That's because I'm using a ribbon but not using a ribbon window, and it's just saying that, hey, I tried to use ancestor relative source binding, and I walked all the way up the tree, and it wasn't a ribbon window on the top, so I don't know what I'm supposed to do now, right? So that's all that those were. Everything still functions fine without that. Go Virtualization improvements. So we have the virtualizing stack panel, which has always been a really kind of cool control. It now has support for partial, or, you know, for pixel level virtualization. So before it was always just item level, so you didn't get the really smooth scrolling that you would get if you use pixel level. You can control the cache size so that you want X number of, say, pages or items before and after, and we're going to cache that for you. It also supports grouping so that you can use virtualized stuff that's been grouped as well, especially doing like data grid work and whatnot. The control itself inside XAML just has a couple of extra attached properties to help you control this, which I'll show in just a couple seconds. And then we also have cross-thread collection access. So how many of you love to see those cross-thread collection errors and or cross-thread binding errors and whatnot inside WPF? All right, I have a fan in the back. Awesome. This is the person. That's actually a somebody who lives in QA, and that's what their job is. But anyway, so if you're not aware of this, we have the UI thread, right? And then you can have any number of background threads, right? And if you try and communicate, you try and touch like a control on the UI thread from a background thread, you're going to get any number of different exceptions. I mean, there's a main exception, and then there's exceptions that get manifested in slightly different ways. The problem with that is if you have, say, like a view model on a background thread that's doing, or say, like loading items on a background thread, and you have controls that are on the UI thread, when that view model is loading items into a collection, right, that those items are sending change notifications down to the UI. And if the UI is wired up to those, if it's bound to those, you're going to have a cross-thread exception there, even though you may not have realized it, because you're trying to call what is essentially a delegate that is over on the UI thread from this background thread without dispatching it. All right. So one way around that is to go and dispatch every single update. And that's just that just sucks for performance. You don't want to go and dispatch every single update if you're doing like hundreds of updates, right? Another approach that we've enabled here is to make it so that you can use synchronization. So you can provide a synchronization object, and that synchronization object will be used to lock the collection and make sure that you're able to do these updates and get them over to the UI without getting these exceptions. So the synchronization object can be anything. In this case, I just like to use object. But the thing that makes it all work is to use this binding operations enable collection synchronization. There are also a couple of events that go along with that so that you can register for collection synchronization when the collection is first registering, when it's first coming up. So if you're not sure exactly when this collection is getting wired up and when it's getting loaded, you can go and simply just sync the event from it and do all the synchronization stuff directly inside that event. There are also, otherwise, you can manually handle the synchronization in a delegate. For most cases, I think just providing a lock object and passing that through and letting WPF handle it's going to be the easiest choice. But if you want that level of control, you do have the level of control to do the locking yourself, again, without having to do any manual dispatching. So let's take a look at both of those. Again, back over to my main window here. So let's look at the virtualizing list box first, since it happens to be right in front of me there. Let me clean that up. Let's get you out of here. I should use Zoom it so it doesn't have that. All right. So I have a list box that I just added to the page. And that list box is bound to the stocks collection that is on the view model that we were looking at. And you notice the four different attached properties that I have there. The first is virtualizing, whether or not we want to have virtualizing for that list box. One place where I ran into really needing virtualization is I was creating a list box that was full of fonts, right? So it was a typical, like a font list box. And each line had the name of the font and then a rendering of that font, right? And I don't know if you've ever looked at the fonts folder on your machine these days, but there are hundreds and hundreds of fonts there. Without virtualization, it took, like when you click the dropdown, it took several seconds before it popped up. With virtualization, it came up immediately because it's only going to deal with the stuff that's being visible right then. Plus, in this case, two pages before and two pages after. And a page is defined by what's visible right then. Okay? Now, you, again, have complete control over this. You can change this cache link and say that you want it to be, you know, another page before, three or five, whatever works for your system, you can tune that. And then the other thing that's really interesting is you get to say what the scroll unit is. And this comes directly into caching, because the way that we've done caching before is when you cache at the item level, we're reusing the UI elements and just replacing the data and stuff, right? So you can't do you can't do pixel level scrolling in that case, because you're just swapping out data and stuff in there. You're not you're not rebuilding the whole tree. You're not rebuilding the container. Well, they've done more work there to make it so that you can use pixel level instead. So let's show you the pixel item level. Actually, I need to go and wire this up. I have the load embed in there. That's okay. So here's that form, right? And if I load some data in here, see, I've got 1,500 items in there. And I am just scrolling this at the item level right now, so that's okay. Now, if I go back in and scroll at the pixel level, there we go. Keep loading a bunch of items in there. All right. And then let's see if I can stop. If you look at the bottom, if you can see all the way at the bottom there, you see we have a partial item visible, right? And also at the top as well, you see a partial item visible. That wasn't possible with the way that we've done virtualization before. That is possible now. And you might think, wow, Pete, that's an awesome feature. But if you're into user experience, you actually know that, especially if you're dealing with larger items that are in your list boxes, being able to show the scrolling at a pixel level gives more of a feeling of scrolling through items than doing it at an item level. So for a user's comprehension of what's going on, scrolling at a pixel level is almost always better. And again, if you have large items where you're only showing three or four in there, if you don't show partial items and stuff, it can get really confusing to figure out if you're actually scrolling or not. Okay. So that's that. And then let's show the cross-thread synchronization. So if I go, back into my view model here, I'm going to add in a function for adding items, right? So this function right here starts up a background process using the task factory method, or the task factory object, and starting new thread on that. There are a zillion different ways you can do this. You know, it's .NET. There are 75 different ways you can accomplish anything. I particularly like the new task approach because it's new and shiny. And it's going to go through, and while it's adding all these items, it's going to keep adding items, sleep for 2 seconds, add items, sleep for 2 seconds. So it's going to add 100 items at a time. Everybody with me so far? Now, if I run this without synchronization, I need to wire the handler for this, so let me do that. If I run this without synchronization, nothing will happen because I didn't wire up the button. So let me do it. Keep loading. Here we are. New event handler. All right. And if you've seen my typing, now you understand why I use those macros. All right. So vm dot start adding items. There we go. Run through this, and I'm gonna keep loading items, and you see what happened? I actually did plan that. It says. And this is one of the other kind of like weird errors that you get now, instead of just like, hey, it's a cross-thread exception. But this one says, this type of collection view does not support changes to its source collection from a thread different from the dispatcher thread. It's complaining because the default collection view that was created as part of this is what's actually throwing up that error. So it's doing that because I tried to add items to a collection, and the problem is not that the collection was defined on the UI thread. The problem is that the event that is, you know, the binding notifications and stuff are happening on the UI thread and are trying to access items on the UI thread from this background thread. All right, so the way that I can fix that is if I go back up into the constructor, I can add in that binding operation I mentioned and just enable this collection synchronization. That's possible because I have this new object line right here that's going to give me the lock object that I want to use. And just calling this binding operations and providing it both the collection and the object to be used for locking is going to make everything all happy. I hope. All right, so try again. Keep loading. And there we go. All right, so this was a big request from some of our ISVs and customers that are doing really large amounts of data. And this combined with some of the shaping stuff we had are specifically interesting to some of the stock trader type classes and other stuff that folks have talked to us about. And we can sit here the rest of the time and just watch the number go up if you'd like. All right, so I think that's a pretty cool feature to add in there. Again, more about stability and more about sort of getting rid of some of the issues that were blocking and kind of making your lives a little miserable. All right. Another feature that we have here is iCustom Type Provider. Any of you use this in Silverlight? No? Not a one. Okay. This is something that if you want to build data-driven applications where, let's say you have a CRM, right, and that CRM has a customer object in its database. Now, as you know, most CRMs allow you to extend the database and extend like the definition of a customer, and those are usually stored in like name value pairs in a database, or maybe they're actually stored in really kind of strongly typed columns in the database. But regardless, the client side wasn't compiled after that, and it doesn't know about these additional features, and so you have to do all this extra work to get those into the rest of the system, maybe get them to work with the binding system, et cetera, because they're just in like a big property bag or a record set or who knows what that you have inside your app. So what iCustom Type Provider does, and this is very similar to a custom type descriptor, except it gets rid of the kind of like the redefining of all of the reflection stuff that was done as part of that. So iCustom Type Provider makes it possible for you to say, here is a customer object. When you want a field from that customer object, come and ask me for it. So you say binding first name, and the system goes to this class and says, give me the first name. And you're like, okay, well, first name I know is actually field number 17 inside this array that I have here. Let me give it back to you. Oh, and first name changed. Well, I'm going to notify you that first name changed from this class. So you can manage all of that inside your code while still being able to use the binding system. And I think it's really important whenever possible to be able to use binding, because you don't get all the other cool stuff that comes along with it, like all the validation stuff and supporting the UI and all the kind of keeping things consistent with the rest of the application unless you do that. Any of you writing data-driven systems like that? The one person, okay. You're becoming my best friend. I worked with a company just before I joined Microsoft that was doing something very similar to this in Silverlight. We totally could have used this feature right at that time because we had to do all the same things that you're talking about or that I was talking about here with property bags and fooling the binding system and a lot of extra hoops. So again, if you want to use this, you're not going to necessarily find WPF examples out of that because unless you talk to him, he might have an interesting example of this, 10 minutes from now, maybe, something like that. But for the rest of you folks, take a look at the Silverlight 5 examples because the code is almost identical. Another feature that we got from Silverlight is iNotify Data Error Info. And this was initially added to Silverlight 4 as part of WCF RIA services. It gives you the ability to say that, hey, there's an error that I have on this field, a validation error, but the way that that's done is actually by a call to like the server or something. It's an asynchronous notification. So you don't have to go and raise an exception or take some action directly when the property is set. You can raise this after the fact. So your user is typing along in all their fields, tab, 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 they keep going through. You've, in the meantime, made three different web service calls, and you realize, hey, these three fields are not going to work together. I'm going to flag those three as requiring validation. So now you have a framework to make that possible. That framework is built directly into this. And this works with everything else, works with the binding system and validation and everything else. Again, lots of Silverlight example code out there if you're interested in playing with that. So one of the other features that I want to talk to you about is live shaping. Live shaping makes it possible for you to do lots of updates to the data on the form without incurring the overhead of a complete resort each time. So let's say, for example, you have 1,000 items in a collection, and you want to be able to inject new items in there, but they're sorted. So normally when you inject new items in there, they're going to go either at the bottom, or you have to figure out where to insert them in, and regardless, your UI is not going to keep up very well, or you're going to have a very poor performing UI that is really trying to keep up with that because of custom code that you've written. This is something that works directly with the collection view. You can set the sort and the filter and the group properties, and all that stuff can be handled for you. Tell it which fields you want to pay attention to. So tell me which fields I want to look at and live sort and live group and whatnot. But again, keep performance in mind, because even though that this really raises the bar in terms of what you can do in your application, there's always, when you're dealing with that much data, you just have to look at it and say, all right, well, how much is too much, and whether or not this is going to really perform well in my own app. So let's take a look at that. Oh. There we go. Number two here. And we'll have plenty of time for Q&A at the end of this session here. So if anybody has any questions they want to ask, let's get into where we are. All right. So in my main view model here, I want to add two functions or two bits of code. So I've got this start updating data function. And this is another one that starts a background process. And what it's going to do is iterate through the collection and start changing values of items that are in that collection. So I'm going to load a bunch of stuff first, and this is going to start iterating through and changing, in this case, the value, I believe. Yes, the value. And the value is something that I'm going to sort on. So normally you would expect this to be a bit of a performance issue. But because I'm using a view and set up the right sort descriptions and all that stuff, and set this property is live sorting to true, so it knows that it's going to be inserting things and kind of resorting stuff along the process. And I tell it to look through via this live sorting properties.add function, look at the value property. When that changes, understand that you're going to have to look and see how to insert stuff into the view correctly. And the code behind that is very optimized for large data sets. So again, think stocks that are sorted by, say, like a dollar amount, in this case, a value amount, where you're constantly sorting that, and they're going to keep jumping up and down in position. Well, this is going to handle that for you. So let me go back over to my XAML and add in a data grid so we can see this. I won't drag in a data grid, but I'll macro one in. There we go. I'm going to bind to that stocks view. That stocks view, again, if we look up at the view model here, that stocks view is defined right here, this list collection view. And I create it based upon the stocks collection right here. So if I run it, all right, and let me load a bunch of items in here. I better watch myself. There we go. Okay, I'm just gonna click on this all day. So now if I hit keep updating, oh. It's not going to do anything because I didn't wire up the button. I know you guys saw that and didn't tell me. All right, let me go back up. That was very anticlimactic. All right. And let's see, click, keep. Oh, there we go. And now I'll wire that up. Start updating data. Here we go. And of course, you know, the ribbon does support using commands and stuff. But this is a demo, so it's all in the code behind. That was a joke, son. All right. Let me load this. My kids are always watching Foghorn Leghorn these days, and unfortunately my son is picking up a lot of stuff from it. Stuff that I thought was really funny when I was little is not funny when you get a six-year-old saying, you're dumb as a bag of hammers. Anyway. All right, so I've got a bunch of items in there, and then if I click on keep updating, I added so many items to it. All right, let me do this one more time. One more time. I might actually be earning the abuse from my son here. All right, so let me just load in a couple things and then do keep updating. There we go. All right, so now you can see the things kind of popping up and down. If I was really clever, I would have had little numbers to show when they move and or color coding or something to show when they move. But you see, this is running pretty well. I mean, I can scroll through fine. I'm not getting a bunch of lag related to this, right? And I'm getting these things all updated in real time in the back end. Right. Now, notice on the list box on the left, that is not changing position of items. That's not something that's sorted, but the data grid itself is changing. Okay, how many of you write systems that do that kind of stuff? I probably just got rid of how many hundreds of lines of nasty code. I say I like I wrote it, but I didn't actually write the feature. I like to think that this is a feature that for, again, applications that need to sort stuff or deal with a lot of different data. And it's not just sorting, it's grouping, like email coming in, and I think like a large large queue of items that you have to work on, and stuff is coming in, and you have them grouped by priority, and you want them to just insert directly into the right priority. This is going to take care of all of those types of situations for you. Okay? All right, so let's go back to this. And as I mentioned, we will have plenty of time for any questions if you want here. So there is some related content that I'd like you to take a look at. If you're interested in building XAML applications, Tim's session was yesterday, but it is recorded. There's also an MVVM in XAML session that I think you should check out. There's a creating line of business Metro apps XAML session as well. I think those were all yesterday. But again, you can watch them all on demand. You can contact me with any questions that you have via my blog at tenrem.net. On Twitter, I'm constantly on there. Or if it's a longer question and you don't feel like splitting it across, 27 different Twitter messages, just go ahead and email me at pete.brown@microsoft.com. All right? Thank you. And don't forget to do your evals, unless you didn't like this session, in which case I encourage you to forget to do your evals.